Tonight on Arena, pianist and composer Federico Albanese talks to us ahead of his Irish tour, and writer Lee Coffey and director Ian Toner on Jigsaw, Ian's new play. is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Federico Albanese is an Italian musician, composer and multi-instrumentalist. And to celebrate the release of his fifth album, Blackbirds and the Son of October, he will be performing at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunlera and the Triskell Arts Centre in Cork on May the 9th and 10th as part of the Between the Notes series. Special guest on the night is cellist Flavia Massimo, and audiences can expect sweeping emotional music that crosses all sorts of genre borders, if such things are allowed to exist in the world of Federico Albanese. I'm guessing they don't exist in his world. I suppose one of the things that struck me particularly, Federico, lovely to have you with us on the programme this evening, was there's a kind of a, there really is this big cinematic swell, very emotional type of feel to lots of the music that I listened to today, at any rate. That was part of the original plan, TV and film music.
Yes, that's correct. That was my that's what I started making instrumental music, essentially. You know, the initial, it was an attempt to try to break into the film world and make music for moving images.
And
it wasn't that easy because I didn't have much credit. So
yes, yeah. And what what moved you then? What happened that changed all of that from moving away? It still has that cinematic feel, certainly in the most recent album. Moving away from necessarily wanting it to be part of a film into something else, into just standalone music that you were composing from your own thoughts and inspirations.
I think it was, honestly, it was the fact that I moved to Berlin. You know, I was living in Milan back in 2011, and then I moved to Berlin, and I sort of like, there was a scene, there was something growing at that time, 2012, 2013 in Berlin, like a new scene of like a new way to explore contemporary classical music that I wasn't aware of, you know. And I think that not only gave me a lot of inspiration somehow, and shaped my music, you know, with the use of electronics and all that. But also, I mean, there were labels, record labels in Germany interested in publishing this kind of music, and which I thought it was like, no, I mean, I thought it wasn't music that, you know, meant for an album.
Mm.
I thought it was meant for, you know, movies and media in general. But then there was, I had a nice encounter with a music manager that told me, like, I think you were better off releasing an album, you know. And so it all started. It was a stroke of luck.
All right, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to listen to a bit of the title track from the current album, Blackbirds and the Son of October. We'll talk a little bit about it afterwards, and we'll see if we can improve that line of yours just a little bit in the meantime. Thank you. Blackbirds and the Sun of October there from Federico Albanese, and that from his new album of the same name, an album and songs and tracks from which I'm sure will feature quite a bit in his two venue tour in the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary and the Triskell Arts Centre in Cork. Bad mannered of me, I must say, Federico, to speak just as Flavia was coming in with the cello at that moment in time, but it did strike me listening to that. I mean, Blackbirds and the Sun of October, you talked to us a little bit before we went to that piece of music about living in Berlin, very much an urban setting, very much a different type of feel to it than where you're living now. You went back home. The call of home was strong.
Yeah. That's the thing. That's exactly that. That piece is the starting point of this new adventure, basically, that I started in my home country, Italy, and I went back to not exactly where I come from, because I come from Milan, but I went back to the countryside, which is the northern Italian countryside, to be precise, in a place called Monferrato, and everything started. That piece is sort of the starting point of this new chapter, I guess, in my career and my life.
And moving from what was, as you said to us, quite an exciting and artistic and vibrant Berlin at the time you were there, I think you made four albums during that period in time. Moving from there back to the pastoral idyll that certainly I hear in Blackbirds and the Sun of October, how freeing was that? How challenging was it? How quickly did you feel it feeding into your music?
This is a very interesting question, Sean. Actually, at first, living in Berlin, you know, when you're a foreigner living abroad, somehow you never feel truly yourself. Somehow, there is a line. You kind of like you're wearing like a veil, like a sort of a mask somehow, because it's not where you belong. So the sense of belonging was missing for so many years. So eventually, and also Berlin is a beautiful city, of course, but it's not the kind of beauty that I seek personally in art form. So my previous albums were all somehow forms of escape. So I was seeking inspiration elsewhere, for instance, in the inner space or in memories and things like this. So far away from reality. And this one is the first time that I actually, everything was already there for me to take. So it's an album about the here and now rather than something outside of that.
Yeah. So is it too simplistic of me to suggest that you were out walking in the countryside around your current home and there were blackbirds and there was sun and it was October?
That's for sure. It was October. There were birds. I'm not sure whether the blackbirds, but it's an image. It's more like a I wanted to represent like a feeling, you know, Sean. It's not a descriptive thing. I think it's more like a feeling. That light in October is extremely special in the countryside. There's something that I just missed for so many years, and I had it there. But the funny thing, I think the thing that is interesting about is that there was a lot of beauty around. It's so beautiful, that place. That, because you asked at the beginning whether it was easy. Actually, it wasn't easy. Because at the beginning, I thought, how could I create any beauty, so to speak, when there's so much beauty already all around? And so at first it was difficult, actually. And then I realized, oh my God, wait a second, maybe this is just like I can just grasp what's around and translate it into music.
And are there kids around? Because I'm here.
There are. I'm sorry, Sean. It's actually, this is a very personal experience I'm sharing with you now. But I am actually going, I was planning to have a beautiful conversation with you in a nice place, but we are actually driving down to Italy from Germany, and unfortunately the plan is not working because we're stuck in the highway.
Right,
and there's a queue, and we couldn't get out where we wanted to. But it's one of those situations where, like, people are starting camping outside of their cars.
Is it? You've been there that long? Okay. Well, listen, I mean, things have been difficult. Let's hope it's not electricity related or anything like that, given recent events in Spain. But perhaps we can entertain the kids and yourself by talking a little bit about the role of story. It struck me, there's a track on the album called A Story Yet to Be Told. I'll come back to that. But there's another track called The Prince and the Emperor, and this is is it a fairy tale, is it a fable from your region?
It's not a fairy tale, actually. It's inspired, that song, it's inspired
inspired by the sort of one of those things that it's half myth, half truth, you know. The story how the Monferrato was actually created, this piece of land in, within the region of Piedmont in Italy. And it's the story of that count that goes way back into the 1100. We're talking about 1100, where the Austro-Hungarian emperor Otto the First was coming down and her to conquer the area, and her daughter fell in love with this knight, this Italian knight called Aleramo, and they flee together and there was a chase, and it's a whole story. But eventually, it's the prince that came back, and because then they flee and they never came back to the emperor, and then eventually they did after 40 years or something, and he gave the prince this piece of land. But it's a long story. It's the story of Aleramo and Adelasia, the story of Monferrato. It's very interesting. You find it online as well.
Yes. Well, there you go. Well, you might need a long story if that traffic jam you're in continues. Let's have a listen. Let's have a listen to a little bit of The Prince and the Emperor. And this time I will wait for Flavia Massimo and the cello to come in.
Okay. Thank you.
Section there from The Prince and the Emperor, the music of Federico Albanese, who joins me from a traffic jam between Germany and Italy. I hope you roll down the windows of the car and let the entire people involved in the traffic jam calm themselves down, because it strikes me, Federico, in the music that you've written, you do leave, there's a lot of space within it. It's the bits between the notes as much as it is the notes themselves that are important.
Yeah, absolutely. There is the actually, probably, to be honest, the space between the notes is even more important than the notes themselves. Mm.
I mentioned that Flavia Massimo will be traveling with you. So is it just the two of you then, the piano and the cello? Now, there were sections there in that track. Flavia, if it was Flavia who was playing, may well have been double stopping on the cello. I don't know. But it certainly sounded like two instruments. But on the album itself, there are sections which there's a lot more than just piano and cello. How do you travel, or do you adjust the performance to suit the instrumentation that you have?
Wait a second. Flavia Massimo, I have to just correct one bit of it. Flavia Massimo did not play cello on the album. There was another
cellist
called
okay.
Arthur Ornig, which is a German cellist. And Flavia Massimo will support, she has her own project, and she will support the shows in Dublin and London. The thing is that I started to consider the idea of, moving along with the band. So to actually recreate the whole album, the way, the way it sounds on the record.
Yeah.
But then I've decided to give the songs a different life. You know, I still believe in for me, it's very meaningful to create a unique experience on a live concert. So in the end, I play most of the tunes of the new album, but they're all sort of rearranged for me to be playing on my own, basically.
And is it just piano, or do you have some form of synthesizer with you as well?
There is electronics. There is a world of electronics on top of the piano that I place on top of the piano instead of the music sheet, so to speak. And I'm just solo. It's just me.
Yeah, it's just yourself, and then Flavia is a support,
exactly.
As I said, in the Dublin, in the Dunleary gig, and again in London. I'm just loving the noises coming. What ages are the children, by the way?
Sorry,
what ages are the children?
The age of my kids. So it's one is 9, the other one is 5, and the other one is 1 year old, and that's the one that's making a little bit of noise at the moment.
Absolutely, and that is perfectly that is perfectly acceptable if you are one.
I very apologize. I can't believe it. I'm doing a live interview in a situation like this.
That's certainly your 1 year old's first appearance on radio, I'm guessing. We might finish up, Federico, with the song for the village, and this is kind of in some ways leads into the whole idea of family, and I think probably a large part of the reason for your moving to Italy. But it's about not necessarily saying country is better than city. It's about looking at how they complement each other, how they contrast with each other.
Yes, absolutely. The reality is that, after living abroad for so many years and in a big city, I mean, I grew up in Milan, which is a huge city, and also and then moved to Berlin, another big city. After a while, you lose the sense of empathy between people. You lose the sense of, there's something missing in this big metropolis, and when you live in a small town, there's like 40 people living there, and you can see that they care for the environment, they care for each other, and there's some magic about that, especially coming back to that and having missed it for so many years. And I think that in general, there's a lack of that, this empathy, this feeling of being together, It's kind of, it's in the air. It's not something that it's palpable, It's not something that you don't even talk about it, but it's always there. You see people caring for things, in a way that they, in the cities, everything is a bit lost and so kind of fragmented that you don't see it anymore. Yeah. So that song is, I wanted to, sort of celebrate that I refound sort of that feeling and with a simple melody, very accessible and simple.
Yes, absolutely. Well, we'll finish up with that. There is a saying in English, it takes a village to raise a child. And I suppose that's part of what the song for the village is all
definitely.
About. So
definitely.
You won't fit the village into your car to deal with the three that you have there for the moment. I hope that you get out of the traffic jam fairly quickly.
It's really like people, they're putting tents outside the highway to starting cooking dinner. It's just everybody's stopped. Nobody's moving.
Yeah, a village all of its own happening on that highway where you are.
Creating a village here.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Federico, thanks for being with us. We listen to the song for the village, and I'll give people details of your concerts afterwards. Take care. For the Village, their composition from Federico Albanese. You can see Federico and his special guest, Flavia Massimo, at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary on May the 9th. And subsequently, there is another gig, whether, not sure whether it's both of them or just Federico, at the Driscoll Arts Centre in Cork, but that is on the 10th. You can find out full details about both gigs on paviliontheatre.ie and driscollartscentre.ie.
It begins with a moment, the business idea that keeps you up at night. So you start researching, developing, prototyping. You nail that big pitch. You get your first customer and dream of thousands more. An entrepreneur's journey is made up of many moments like these. And Enterprise Ireland is here for all of them. Whether you're looking to raise funding, get expert advice, or expand internationally, for every startup moment, we're there. For more information, visit enterprise-ireland.com/startup. Enterprise Ireland, with you on your startup journey.
The RTE Short Story Competition is now open for entries. Since 1986, this competition has rewarded the best new Irish fiction written for radio. 10 stories will be shortlisted and broadcast on RTE Radio 1 with a top prize of €5,000. Closing date, May 23rd. To enter, see rte.ie/writing. The RTE Short Story Competition, in honour of Francis McManus. RTE, your public service media.
Lee Coffey's new play Jigsaw is a portrait of Jigsaw Jim, an outcast of a man shunned by his mother, wife and daughter for something he did 20 years earlier when he was hooked on cocaine. He's out of prison now. He's been sober for 10 years, and even though he's clean, he's still down on his luck. His main aim in life is to see his daughter again. Alan Devine plays Jim as the older man, and Craig Connolly is his younger self. Jigsaw is set in Dublin, directed by Ian Toner for Glass Mask Theatre. I'm delighted to have both Ian, the director, and Lee Coffey, the writer, with me in studio this evening. And you can watch proceedings, by the way, if you so wish, on rte.ie/arena. The way you've done this play, Lee, is quite interesting in that there's kind of part one and part two. Part one is contemporary Jim, we meet him as well. Tell me the man we meet at the beginning of part one, and we'll talk about the form of the play after that.
Yeah, so we meet Jim in modern day Dublin in 2025, and he's living on the streets and his life hasn't gone too well, but we don't know as to why. And then we start to follow him just on his day to day, and all of a sudden then he starts to come across people from his past, which unlocks the past.
Yeah.
And then we start to follow that as an audience, but we drop the audience in the middle of the action, the aftermath of an event, as opposed to building up to an event.
Yeah, so what we're getting in that opening section of the play, at any rate, is this older character looking back on his earlier life. And that is Alan Devine who's playing
the
older character. Yeah. And then Craig Connolly is on stage. There's only the two of them on stage. Craig Connolly is on stage, obviously, as a younger actor, and he will play the younger Jim later on. But he plays everybody that the older Jim meets along the way.
Yeah, they do. It's a multi-character piece that, depending on the act, Alan plays Jim in the first act, and then, as you said, Craig plays everybody else. So he plays flashbacks of Jim when he was younger. He plays Jim's consciousness. He plays Jim's addiction. He plays the sights and sounds of Dublin. He plays the people he crosses. He plays the family members that come, that resurface.
plays the woman in on Moore Street or selling the fruit
exactly.
along the way.
He plays Angela on Moore Street. He plays Jer, a friend of his. He plays tour guides. He plays a lot of receptionists. He plays multiple characters.
Yeah, a lot of characters.
And it was that there from the beginning in that format? Because then in the second half it flips and we're back in the event that is going to be the kind of the explanation of where Jim is in 2025. And we get the younger Jim, played by Craig Connolly. He's there as just himself the whole time. And the older actor now, Alan Devine, is playing everybody else in that younger life. Was that format there from the very outset?
Yeah, that was the script as I first read it. The play belongs to the tradition of monologue plays in a sense, but it's also with this other supporting actor. So it's very dynamic, it's very fast moving, a lot of characters, a lot of locations, challenging.
Yeah, and I suppose you had to make a decision with both Craig and Alan quite early on as to how these shifts in character would happen. Like, how broad are the strokes? Because, like, these characters, even when they're playing, you know, if he's playing at one stage, Haley, the wife, has been played by the older actor. At another stage, the daughter is being played by the younger actor. And these are quite emotionally nuanced characters, so you can't just do big broad strokes.
No, you can't. The tone of the piece was really interesting. It was something we discovered in the first few weeks of rehearsals, how to convey that, because the characters, yes, they're very deep, and we need to see a lot from those characters, those other supporting characters as well. There's some smaller characters that we come across in the journey through Dublin on a day-to-day basis that you can kind of play with big broad strokes.
Yeah, like the fruit seller is only going to have a couple of lines, and we're going to want to hear the fruit seller sound.
Yeah, but Jim's family, his wife and his daughter, those stories are as important in the play as Jim's own story, so we really need to explore those characters. So it's really challenging, but I use that word in a good way, I think.
And for you, Lee, did you come at it from Jim's point of view from the very outset, or did these other characters demand to be heard? Particularly, I think it's particularly the wife, Haley, and the daughter, Chloe, and Jim's mother as well. These characters have things to say and that they want Jim to hear.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, as Ian said, we've also filmed some gorgeous moments because the two actors played them at different stages as well.
Yeah.
Beautiful mirrors of each other and moments to just remind the audience that they're playing the same character. But when it comes to those other characters having just as much of a voice as Jim, yes, it's being told by Jim, but I think we've always had that conversation in the room that every Haley, Chloe, Jim are all as important as Jim himself in this story, and we need to make sure, because if we only have it as a one-sided story, then the audience aren't going to believe us, and we won't add that nuance and the weight to those scenes that it needs.
Well, I want to take a clip that you sent into us, and this is from the beginning of part two. So it's the young Alan, the young Jim, played by Craig Connolly, who's playing the one character here, and you'll hear the older voice, the Alan Devine's voice. It's not huge shifts because it's Haley, who's one of the main other characters, the wife, who's one of the main other characters in this scene. But you get a sense of that it isn't this big broad brushstroke from one character to the next.
Get up.
Get up.
Get up.
Get up.
Get up.
And get the...
What?
Down to breakfast, sleepyhead.
Haley always woke me like that, mostly. When I did nothing stupid the night before, after a night out, you know.
Will you be late?
Oh, only a couple of hours.
Okay, love, enjoy.
Then it's 4 a.m. and you're convinced you're quiet. A ballerina coming in, but up from the pillow comes...
Are you for real?
Ah, love, you waited up.
No, you woke me up.
You're a light sleeper.
You rang the bell.
I forgot my keys. Seeing as we're about up.
4 minutes of passion.
Better than 3 minutes of passion.
Yeah, enjoy the couch.
Joke's on her. Our couch was deadly. The couch was a bit of a reoccurrence. Me and Haley, childhood sweethearts.
And that's Craig Connolly there, the second voice that we heard as Jim, the young Jim. And we also heard in there Alan Devine as the older Jim, and Haley, the younger version of the wife. With me in studio this evening, Lee Coffey, writer of the play Jigsaw. And also here is Ian Toner, who's directing the piece. And it gives us a sense, you talked about this being in the tradition of monologue plays. It really is one character telling us the whole story. That's what we're getting in some ways, Lee.
It is, as Ian said, it's a traditional, it's a monologue play in a sense, but then there are moments that we break into scenes. And what we, Ian and the lads in rehearsals have been playing around with is making those moments and making them scenes, which I think adds an element to the play and more of a dynamic element than just a direct story, direct address play, which I think they really, really work. Because what it also does is it adds realism to the play, which I think is needed, because then the audience will buy into the characters and the situation more so than somebody just standing there telling them the story. They actually physically see them and embody the characters.
Two very important themes within the play, and there are lots of important themes there for sure, but two very important themes are addiction. Jim is clearly has been addicted. He's clean now, but there's lots of things that he's saying now that you're worried that he could slip back quite easily. And domestic violence, these are huge themes to take on. What sent you in that direction?
I think what I mentioned earlier is that I always try and talk about human stories. And I think these are issues that people can relate to and deal with. And they may not have experienced them themselves, but they know what it's like to be a husband or a brother or a son. And these issues are prevalent in society, and I want to talk about them, and I don't want to shy away from them either. But it's also adding a conversation to it. And we spoke about it before, about the addiction element of the play. And in that, it's Jim trying to grasp at what does he think his wife wants him to be, this confidence, this air of somebody else, to be a different person, which isn't who he is. So he feels he needs to alter who he is, and he feels, unfortunately, that drugs are the way to do that. And that's why we embody and we bring the voice of the addiction. We physicalise it in both halves of the play.
Yeah.
And I think it's really affecting when we hit it on the head, because we introduce it, first of all, and the audience don't know what it is. And then when we go back in Act Two, we introduce what it is, and the audience know that it's the voice of his addiction that's following him around, and his urge to try and not be something else, try not to be his father.
And that aspect of domestic violence is certainly something that can't be shied away. While we don't see, I don't think, we will see a lot of violence on stage, Ian, I think a lot of violence will be related to us, which in some ways can be more upsetting.
Yeah, no, it's all suggested. There's nothing very violent about the play, the way it's presented. I think those subjects are dealt with really sensitively in the script. And I think, again, in what you're talking about playing characters in broad strokes and stuff like that, that's why we're dealing with things that are very sensitive. So, you know, it's two male actors on stage, and a lot of the supporting characters are female as well, things like that. So you can't, you know, slip into sort of overacting or broad strokes or big choices like that.
And it did say, I want to be careful about talking about how things begin to resolve themselves coming towards the end of the second part of the play. Hayley, the wife character, and we're looking at her back at the time of this awful event, which has sent Jim's life, already in a bit of a spiral, but it's really sent it off the rails. We start to see things from her point of view, and she makes some really difficult choices and takes quite extreme measures to follow things through. What kind of sympathy where are you hoping our sympathies will lie in those scenes, particularly where Hayley has to make these, you know, rash, very, very difficult decisions?
So we spoke about this a lot when I was talking to Rex about the script when it was in draft one.
Rex Ryan, who's
the artistic director of Glass Mask. We knew we had to earn that moment because it's so...
And I want to be careful not to give
anything away. But as you said, it is extreme. And it's kind of, I was also very interested in what happens to somebody when they are pushed to the very end and they're left with no choice and they have to make a decision to alter their life for the greater good, for the life of their daughter. And we have spoken rehearsals too that we need to earn that moment, because if we don't get to that moment and the audience believes it, what does everything that precedes that do? We need to get to it and we need to build it and make it believable as a moment and understand where Hayley came from and why she made that decision.
And the other aspect of this is we have Hayley's side of that story, but we also have Jim. It's Jim who's telling us the story. And how much of a discussion have you had around how reliable is Jim? How much can we believe what Jim is telling us?
Yeah, I think me and Lee have slightly different feelings about
this. Yeah, we
do. That's good.
That is good, because it means I'm challenging the text a little bit. But I think what we get is very much, it is Jim's side of the story, but I think he's attempting to be honest, but I also think it's very open to ambiguity. And I think it is the sort of show that hopefully people will come see and, you'll chat to other people about it afterwards. I think they'll be open for discussion afterwards as to who believes who.
And where you see, you believe we can believe him? That's kind of where you're sitting.
Yeah, I think so.
And are you slightly different from that then, Lee?
Well, I think like ambiguity.
Well,
you get,
I think it's more ambiguous.
Ian thinks it's more ambiguous, but I would think that it isn't, because when we tell the story, he also goes into the horrific things that he does. Mm. And I think if you're a reliable narrator, you tend to sugarcoat things that you did yourself and try paint yourself that you're not the wrong here, and you're the only one that is justified in your actions and what you've done. Whereas we don't do that with Jim.
Yeah.
He does some horrific things throughout the course of this play to get Hayley up against the wall, as we mentioned. But I do think, as what Ian said, it's always good when you come out of a play or you watch a film or you go see a show and you're talking with a fellow audience member and they got something totally different to what you did. There'll be people that come out and they say, I'm on Jim's side here, or I'm on Hayley's side.
Yeah.
And you want those conversations. I think good art should do that. It should challenge people. And I may have one thing and what I feel as the writer, but Ian, as the director who's putting a shape on this and bringing this to life, may have something totally different in his mind.
Yeah, well, I was watching a documentary, I think it was on BBC, during the holiday period, Stephen Ray talking about ambiguity and the importance of ambiguity, because it's not you telling the audience what they should feel or think, it's allowing them to make their minds up about it. You're heading into the final weeks. When do you, you're in the final week now, Ian?
Yeah, we're in rehearsals in Tech now and previewing on Tuesday, Wednesday, opening Thursday next week.
All right. Well, listen, very best of luck and hope that it all goes very well for you. That is Jigsaw by Lee Coffey. It's at Glass Mask Theatre on Dawson Street in Dublin from the 6th through until the 24th of May. And you can get full details on glassmasktheatre.com.
RTE Radio 1.
Aiken Promotions presents Steve Earle.
Let's be traveling my head down the town. No local yoga gonna shut
50
down.
Years of songs and stories.
And I ask your friend, what's a fella?
Live at the Helix, October 28th.
Because her hair is black and her eyes are
Tickets
blue.
Available now.
Music updates on RTE Radio 1.
My name is Niall Hatch, and my Dawn Chorus bird impression is the wood pigeon.
Woo 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 woo.
Listen to the real birds sing, the Dawn Chorus live, in the early hours of Sunday, May 4th. Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 30 years on RTE Radio 1.
Now, really looking forward to next Tuesday. That is May the 6th. You've heard me speaking about it over the past couple of nights. A very special programme taking place in Studio One in the RTE Radio Centre. The iconic trad fusion band Keela will be joining us on Arena to launch their new album, Raise the Road Live. It, of course, features Paul Frost Brass, and it will have all the energy of a Keela live performance, the album, and of course, the performance will be live next Tuesday, so it will have all that energy as well. Paul Frost has managed somehow to get funk and mambo and New Orleans jazz all mixed in with Keela's contemporary composition. Now, if you want to come along to the Studio One in the RTE Radio Centre on May the 6th and hear Keela perform live with the Paul Frost Brass, all you have to do is email us on arena@rte.ie. Put Keela in the subject line of the email. And if you can't make it to studio, of course, you can listen to us here on RTE Radio 1, on the radio app and on RTE Radio Player. 7 p.m. we will be live on Radio 1. Here's a little taster of Keela and their music, Shumalaba.
Shamalaba shodi mochalim, shamalaba fama hamalim, shamalaba shodena kademe, shamalaba tarashimachtiyale, shamalaba moho vinsu, shamalaba mohoi tanstro, shamalaba smahogan to be rehom, shamalaba shahushiyale, sula gangavana to gavela to mavogan to the sula gangavlasha to morfo. Sula ganga vana tu gavela tu mavana tu de sula ganga vlasha tu mafo.
hope more fool, nor a folk I made a fool. Shamalaba machumas marum, shamalaba machodlim soon, shamalaba marahaha me maia, shamalaba saralatala mahel, shamalaba mahavin soon, shamalaba mahai constro, shamalaba shamaramala me, shamalaba ekoludana mahena, sulagamga bala to the villa to my wagon to, sulagamga blasha to my foe. Sulaganga bala to the villa to my wagon to, the sulaganga blasha to my foe. Shamalaba shadima khalin, shamalaba fama amalin, shamalaba shadena kadele, shamalaba talash machtiyane, shamalaba mahavin so, shamalaba mahoy kanstro, shamalaba smahagan to be reho, shamalaba shahuchime, sulagam gavala to gavala to mahoga to the sulagam gavala shatim mahoga. Sulagam gavala to gavala to mahoga to the sulagam gavala shatim mahoga.
Shamalaba from Keela, and our special next Tuesday, May the 6th, with Keela and Paul Frost Brass, as they launch the album Raise the Road. If you want tickets, there's still a few left. You can email us on arena@rte.ie, and don't forget to put Keela in the subject line. I think that most of us will know from history that Constance Gore Booth was the daughter of Anglo-Irish gentry from Lissadell House in County Sligo. But how did she become Constance Markovich? Who was Count Casimir Markovich, the man she married after meeting while they both studied art in Paris? Well, some of those questions will be answered with an exhibition at the State Apartments at Dublin Castle. Casimir Markovich, a Polish artist in Bohemian Dublin, 1903 to 1913. It's currently on view, is the exhibition. It's curated by Catherine Milligan and Emily Mark Fitzgerald. And Emily is with me in studio this evening. It is this, I said it to you before we came to air, Emily, that yes, we all know Countess Markovich, but I don't know that many of us, I certainly knew very little about Casimir. He was an artist. Did this all get lost in the revolutionary excitement that mostly in this country we know of Constance Markovic from that point of view. Mm.
I think so, definitely. You know, he kind of drops out of the picture a little bit because he's only in Dublin about 10 years, you know, 1903 to 1913, which is the focus of the exhibition. And he's actually a very significant figure within the Irish Revival, within theatre, within painting and art and setting up art institutions. So the exhibition's really trying to kind of bring him back, as it were.
Yeah, so he deserves his moment in the limelight that perhaps Constance has had for for quite a long time. And there are lots of different aspects to him, but they met at Art College in Paris, wasn't it?
They did, yeah. So, I mean, this is a period where lots of students from Ireland and art students from Poland are travelling to Paris. It's really the epicenter of art education and bohemian life. And both of them come from families of the gentry. They're both attracted to Paris because...
They can afford to be bohemian.
They can afford to be bohemian, but also because it's a place of liberation. It's a place where you can throw off, you know, your backgrounds and your upbringings and be there at the kind of, you know, the heart of the artistic world. So that's where they meet in 1899. And they're very similar in terms of their temperament and what they're interested in. So they immediately become attached.
Yeah, so they're attached purely on a romantic scale to start out. And I believe quite a romance too. There was no half measures in this particular suit.
Not at all, no. I mean, in the accounts of their meeting in Paris also reference not only the fact that they're very similar in terms of the things that they are enjoying in life, but they're also very tall. So everyone always comments on this because...
You'd see them coming down the street.
Yeah, because Casimir was 6'4" and Constance herself was about 6 feet tall as well. So, you know, they seemed very well matched. They loved to cycle everywhere. They loved parties. So they really kind of become part of, you know, the bohemian lifestyle there in Paris at the time.
And bohemian lifestyle is one aspect of becoming to Bohemian Dublin in 1903. Artistically, how established were they, or particularly Casimir, how established was he at that period in Paris?
He's very highly regarded, actually. So he exhibits at the Paris Salon, for example. Both of them are enrolled in the Académie Julien, which is one of the main draws for especially Irish artists of the period. So they're there learning all of the kinds of things that students at that period are learning in Paris. They're learning about Impressionism, you know, they're being exposed to a whole range of different styles. And Casimir is a very accomplished artist, even at a young age. So one of the famous pictures of Constance that he creates actually is created during this period, during their courtship in Ireland.
Is this the full-length portrait of her in the white dress?
Yes, yeah, that's it. It's created in Paris and then it's now in the collection of the National Gallery of Ireland.
Yeah, these are available for you to look at on both X and Instagram at RTE Arena. And I'm just looking at that picture of her, or that painting of her. I mean, it is... beautiful detail.
Mm-hmm. And it's huge. It's a huge painting.
Yeah. How tall is it? Well, you know, as often is the case for an art piece to look like life size, it has to be larger than life size.
It is, yeah. And it's about life size. You know, it's a very large painting. What's interesting in it too is that you see that she's wearing a wedding band. But this isn't a wedding band from her marriage to Casimir. This is a wedding band she purportedly wore this band that was a symbol of her marriage to art, that this was going to be her calling, as it were. So that's actually why she's wearing the wedding band in the photo, or in the painting, rather.
Yes, exactly. And again, she's profile onto us. She's a side profile onto us and gazing off over towards the light. But really struck by the whiteness of her dress and how Casimir could capture that. How would you describe that style, Emily?
Yeah, it's quite a loose brushwork that he's using. It's a very kind of impressionistic style. At the same time, it's very much in the mold of a society portrait. It's very polished. It's very accomplished. It has these kinds of symbolic references as well to romantic love with the particular flowers that are on the table and whatnot. So it is really kind of showing her with this these associations of romanticism and love, but in a to a degree that's very, very highly finished.
Within the catalogue itself, there's a great picture of, and this is a photograph of Casimir and Constance. And yeah, as you say, he's marginally taller than her, but they're both quite tall. Yeah. Again, looking off into the distance, a little bit of the dramatic and a little bit of the actor feel off, of the costumed feel off this particular photograph.
Absolutely. That was one of the most fun things about researching Casimir and Constance in this period is they both loved parties and fancy dress. And there's wonderful photographs and images of them indulging in this in Paris and also later on in Dublin as well.
Yeah, and the bicycle outfits, I believe, were particularly...
They cycled for their honeymoon in Normandy. So yeah, so this was a really keen part of their lives.
Yeah, well, these could be sexy. She's wearing kind of...
She's wearing kind of pantaloons.
She could cycle with. However, the Paris period did end and they came back to Ireland. Was it difficult for Casimir Casimir to make that decision, do you think? Or was it just there was no winning against Constance Markovic?
It doesn't seem to have been any, you know, disagreement at all. He was very happy to move to Ireland. And he really threw himself into Irish society immediately, despite the fact that, by all accounts, you know, his English, he was still learning English. He and Constance spoke French to one another quite a lot. But no, he becomes immediately sort of enmeshed in Bohemian life in Dublin and is, by all accounts, is very happy.
How Bohemian was life in Dublin? We talked about the bohemianness of Paris. How bohemian were things here?
Quite a bit. I mean, this is the high point of the Irish revival, you know. So you have Yeats and Lady Gregory starting the Abbey. You have all kinds of theatre activity happening both in the centre and also at the margins, with lots of little companies staging work. You know, you have painters who are working in Dublin, starting new organisations and exhibitions. And Constance and Casimir are right at the heart of all of that activity.
And Casimir had some sort of a background in theatre as well, did he?
Well, he didn't initially, actually. He comes into theatre when he moves to Ireland.
All right.
Yeah. So he gets the theatre bug, as it were, at that time. So he becomes really interested in the world of theatre. And it's not until 1907 that he actually appears on stage.
And he's originally from Ukraine, and then they became Polonized, if that's the correct. Is that the adjective for when they moved to Poland, the family?
Yeah, no, it's a little bit of a complicated geopolitical background, but his family were actually Polish landowners who were settled in what is now Ukraine. Now, all of it was the Russian Empire at the time. So, of course, Russia and Poland and Ukraine have had a very complex history over centuries. But in essence, Casimir himself was born just outside of Kyiv and in what is now Ukraine. And so his family would have had, you know, they would have had peasants on their land who were Ukrainian, but had relatively good relationship with their Polish landlords.
So coming back then to this time that they were spending in Dublin and living in Dublin, and this exhibition concentrates on the period 1903 to 1913, so just that little bit ahead of the Easter Rising. How did he fare? How did Casimir fare here as an artist?
He fared pretty well. So on the one hand, while Casimir and Constance are very involved with Bohemian life in Dublin, on the other, you know, Constance, she's a Gore Booth. So when she moves back to Ireland, she also becomes part of Dublin Castle and the Dublin Castle Society, which is a totally different, you know, side of a social circle from that. And Casimir, of course, is a member of the gentry as well. So he also kind of slides into that world very easily. So quite a number of his early patrons are actually people who are from the Anglo-Irish ascendancy, and they form important patrons for his work. And he does portraiture and other things like that.
Yeah, because I'm looking at another one, another image within the catalogue, which is part of the Dublin Castle collection, in fact, is the investiture of the Earl of Mayo as a Knight of St. Patrick in 1905. So this is, he's already established enough to be getting this type of commission.
Absolutely. And for us as well, the fact that the exhibition is actually in Dublin Castle is particularly resonant, because that as a site was so important for him in terms of this patronage, and is very much a part of their early life. The both of them are regularly attending balls in Dublin Castle until 1908. We have some wonderful photographs of them from that time. And so they're kind of juggling these two spheres of their lives. On the one hand, the kind of bohemian, you know, theatre making and painting and art and philosophy, and on the other, being part of a higher society.
And how did he fare, and how did himself and Mr. Yeats fare with each other? I can't imagine that was a very happy relationship.
Well, I think when it comes to Irish theatre, gossip and rivalries always ensue. And that's the case too for Casimir, you know, because he is part of the groups of people who are starting alternatives to the Abbey. So he and Yeats did not always get along.
That would not go down well.
And so any kind of sense, you know, from Yeats and Lady Gregory that their turf was being encroached upon often was resisted. So, but what's really interesting is there have been so many more histories written recently about these smaller companies and how significant they were in terms of growing the culture around theatre in Ireland.
And you mentioned the connection with Ukraine and these, yes, they were considered to be good landlords. What was Countess Markovic, what was her attitude to that, given that she was coming from this Republican background and this, you know, nationalist background here in Ireland?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. Now, Constance and Casimir visit Ukraine together in 1902 and 1903. So in a sense, her visits there actually predate her involvement in the revolutionary movement. But what's really interesting is that we see in the work that she produces there, which is included in the exhibition, we have these marvelous photographs that are in the Markovic family descendants collections that Constance actually took of Ukraine, and paintings that both of them created there. And what we see is that she is beginning to have this interest in the peasant subject. She's interested in the landscape. And you can see that her kind of consciousness around nationalism is growing, and it's very much influenced by her experiences from the, with the Polish family, but also her time in Ukraine.
There was another image that, that struck me. It's of a Russian cottage. At what point was this done in Kazimir's output?
That's fairly early on, and it's very similar to a lot of the paintings that he creates. Again, it's in quite a loose impressionistic kind of brush style, and he painted quite a lot of these images of cottages. And again, this type of subject was really popular in French painting of the period, so he, they're not kind of unique in being interested in these kinds of subjects, but they painted both Irish and Ukrainian, and in this case it's called a Russian cottage, but it's most likely actually in Ukraine.
Another one that I think we have also put up on social media is a portrait of George Russell, AE, from 1904. This has a very different style in many ways. It's kind of a darkness and a very, if such a thing is possible to see in a painting, but it has a kind of a Russian feel. Russell has this look of Russianness off him in this portrait.
It does a bit. I mean, what you see, I think, in that portrait, which is just extraordinary, it's one of my favourite works of his, is this deep intellect of Russell. Mm. Yeah, so Russell is one of their first friends in Dublin.
And would Kazimir have been more attached perhaps to George Russell AE than he was to W.B. Yeats?
Oh, definitely. No, he and Russell got on extraordinarily well. In fact, Russell's very first exhibitions as a painter were with Kazimir and Constance. So that's the first time actually that he publicly exhibits his own paintings. And so all of them are very much involved in things like the United Arts Club. Constance and Kazimir are regular attendees at AE's salons that he held in his home. So that's a really important connection. And that portrait of AE that you're talking about was one of the first acquisitions of the Hugh Lane Gallery.
The only true bohemian is how Patrick Quigley describes Kazimir Markovitch in Dublin.
Yeah, Patrick was one of the most important biographers of Kazimir. Yeah.
So he's perhaps a little biased on Kazimir, is he?
Well, I suppose anyone who does a biography is a bit, but Patrick's done phenomenal work really looking at the life story of Kazimir and also his son, Stashko, who is Constance's stepson, actually. And actually, by the way, Stashko becomes one of Constance's most important biographers. And so Kazimir's son, he actually gives a lot of the material about Constance to the National Museum and National Library after her death. So he's very important to
the
story as well.
There's a wonderful portrait of Kazimir in kind of military outfit, but very kind of decorative.
It's an imaginative, he's in the costume of a hussar.
Daddy was a hero.
But I mean, it's all kind of a fantasy, but you see his kind of swagger and his personality really shining through that painting.
All right. Well, the exhibition is currently on display in Dublin Castle, and it runs through, I think I had it in front of me there, but I seem to have lost it now. It runs through until
the 14th of September.
14th of September, and Dublin Castle for full details on that. And that is our lot for this evening here on Arena. Paul Murnock was on sound. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Research this evening was by Paula Shields, and the programme was produced by Reg Luby. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RTÉ Radio 1. And Ray Cuddihy will be with you after the news.
RTE News on Radio 1 with Shane McGowan. Good evening. The family of Michael Gaine, who was reported missing from his home near Kenmare in County Kerry last month, have appealed for information. Gardaí have reclassified the investigation from missing person to a homicide case. Our Southern editor, Pascal Sheehy.
The appeals by Mike Gaine's wife Janice and his sister Noreen O'Regan were recorded by Gardaí this morning and released publicly this afternoon. Janice Gaine described her husband as her best friend. She said his disappearance has been devastating.
His disappearance is totally out of character. Well, we knew that from day one. And if there is anybody that has any information about Michael, do please come forward and talk to the Gardaí. We just want Michael to come home.
Mike Gaine's sister, Noreen O'Regan, described him as a loving husband, brother and uncle. She said the family was appealing for answers and asked for the public's help. At a news conference this afternoon, Garda Superintendent John Ryan of Killarney said the investigating team is satisfied that Mike Gaine's disappearance was out of character and at odds with his pattern of behaviour. He confirmed that a criminal investigation has begun. Pascal Sheehy, RTÉ News, Kenmare, County Kerry.
A spokesperson for the former US President Joe Biden has defended his administration's economic policies during the past 4 years, saying the best performing economy in the world was now plummeting what he described as a Trump session. He was responding to criticism by his successor, Donald Trump, who has blamed Mr. Biden for a fall in gross domestic product in an annual rate of 0.3% in the first 3 months of this year. According to a report by the US Bureau of Economic Analysis, the decrease in real GDP reflected on increases in imports and reduced government spending. It also noted that the US economy grew by 2.4% during the fourth quarter of 2024. Speaking at the White House, President Trump said he did not take over until the 20th of January and that the figures had nothing to do with tariffs.
You probably saw some numbers today, and I have to start off by saying that's Biden, that's not Trump, because we came in on January, this is the quarterly numbers. And we came in and I was very against everything that Biden was doing in terms of the economy destroying our country.
Met Aaron has said provisional recordings at weather stations across the country indicate that 25.8 degrees was the highest temperature reached today.
Lee Coffey's new play Jigsaw is a portrait of Jigsaw Jim, an outcast of a man shunned by his mother, wife and daughter for something he did 20 years earlier when he was hooked on cocaine. He's out of prison now. He's been sober for 10 years and even though he's clean, he's still down on his luck. His main aim in life is to see his daughter again. Alan Devine plays Jim as the older man and Craig Connolly is his younger self. Jigsaw is set in Dublin and directed by Ian Toner for Glass Mask Theatre. I'm delighted to have both Ian, the director, and Lee Coffey, the writer, with me in studio this evening. And you can watch proceedings, by the way, if you so wish, on rte.ie/arena. The way you've done this play, Lee, is quite interesting in that there's kind of part one and part two. Part one is contemporary Jim, we meet him as well. Tell me the man we meet at the beginning of part one, and we'll talk about the form of the play after that.
Yeah, so we meet Jim in modern day Dublin in 2025, and he's living on the streets and his life hasn't gone too well, but we don't know as to why. And then we start to follow him just on his day to day, and all of a sudden then he starts to come across people from his past, which unlocks the past.
Yeah.
And then we start to follow that as an audience, but we drop the audience in the middle of the action, the aftermath of an event, as opposed to building up to an event.
Yeah, so what we're getting in that opening section of the play, at any rate, is this older character looking back on his earlier life. And that is Alan Devine who's playing
the
older character. Yeah. And then Craig Connolly is on stage. There's only the two of them on stage. Craig Connolly is on stage, obviously, as a younger actor, and he will play the younger Jim later on. But he plays everybody that the older Jim meets along the way.
Yeah, they do. It's a multi-character piece that, depending on the act, Alan plays Jim in the first act. And then, as you said, Craig plays everybody else. So he plays flashbacks of Jim when he was younger. He plays Jim's consciousness. He plays Jim's addiction. He plays the sights and sounds of Dublin. He plays the people he crosses. He plays the family members that come, that resurface.
Plays the woman in on Moor Street or selling the fruit
exactly.
along the way.
He plays all of these Angela people. On Moor Street. He plays Jer, a friend of his. He plays tour guides. He plays a lot of receptionists. He plays multiple characters.
Yeah, a lot of characters.
And it was that there from the beginning in that format? Because then in the second half it flips and we're back in the event that is going to be the kind of the explanation of where Jim is in 2025. And we get the younger Jim, played by Craig Connolly, he's there as just himself the whole time, and the older actor now, Alan Devine, is playing everybody else in that younger life. Was that format there from the very outset?
Yeah, that was the script as I first read it. The play belongs to the tradition of monologue plays in a sense, but it's also with this other supporting actor. So it's very dynamic, it's very fast moving, a lot of characters, a lot of locations, challenging.
Yeah, and I suppose you had to make a decision with both Craig and Alan quite early on as to how these shifts in character would happen. Like, how broad are the strokes? Because, like, these characters, even when they're playing, you know, if he's playing at one stage, Hayley, the wife, has been played by the older actor. At another stage, the daughter is being played by the younger actor. And these are quite emotionally nuanced characters, so you can't just do big broad strokes.
No, you can't. The tone of the piece was really interesting. It was something we discovered in the first few weeks of rehearsals, how to convey that, because the characters, yes, they're very deep, and we need to see a lot from those characters, those other supporting characters as well. There's some smaller characters that we come across in the journey through Dublin on a day-to-day basis that you can kind of play with big broad strokes.
Yeah, like the fruit seller is only going to have a couple of lines and we're going to want to hear the fruit seller sound.
Yeah, but Jim's family, his wife and his daughter, those stories are as important in the play as Jim's own story, so we really need to explore those characters. So it's really... it's really challenging, but I use that word in a good way, I think.
And for you, Lee, did you come at it from Jim's point of view from the very outset, or did these other characters demand to be heard? Particularly, I think it's particularly the wife, Hayley, and the daughter, Chloe, and Jim's mother as well. These characters have things to say and that they want Jim to hear.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, as Ian said, we've also filmed some gorgeous moments because the two actors played them at different stages as well.
Yeah.
Beautiful mirrors of each other and moments to just remind the audience that they're playing the same character. But when it comes to those other characters having just as much of a voice as Jim, yes, it's being told by Jim, but I think we've always had that conversation in the room that every Hayley, Chloe, Jim are all as important as Jim himself in this story, and we need to make sure, because if we only have it as a one-sided story, then the audience aren't going to believe us, and we won't add that nuance and the weight to those scenes that it needs.
Well, I want to take a clip that you sent into us, and this is from the beginning of part two. So it's the young Alan, the young Jim, played by Craig Connolly, who's playing the one character here, and you'll hear the older voice, the Alan Devine's voice. It's not huge shifts because it's Hayley, who's one of the main other characters, the wife, who's one of the main other characters in this scene. But you get a sense of that it isn't this big broad brushstroke from one character to the next.
Get up.
Get up.
Get up.
Get up.
Get up.
And get the...
what?
Down to breakfast, sleepyhead.
Hayley always woke me like that, mostly. When I did nothing stupid the night before, after a night out, you know?
Will you be late?
Oh, only a couple of hours.
Okay, love, enjoy.
Then it's 4 a.m. and you're convinced you're quiet. A ballerina coming in, but up from the pillow comes...
Are you for real?
Ah, love, you waited up.
No, you woke me up.
You're a light sleeper.
You rang the bell.
I forgot my keys. Seeing as we're both up.
4 minutes of passion.
Better than 3 minutes of passion.
Yeah, enjoy the couch.
Joke's on her. Our couch was deadly. The couch was a bit of a reoccurrence. Me and Hayley, childhood sweethearts.
And that's Craig Connolly there, the second voice that we heard as Jim, the young Jim. And we also heard in there Alan Devine as the older Jim, and Hayley, the younger version of the wife. With me in studio this evening, Lee Coffey, writer of the play Jigsaw, and also here is Ian Toner, who's directing the piece. And it gives us a sense, you talked about this being in the tradition of monologue plays. It really is one character telling us the whole story. That's what we're getting in some ways, Lee.
It is, as Ian said, it's a traditional, it's a monologue play in a sense. But then there are moments that we break into scenes. And what Ian and the lads in rehearsals have been playing around with is making those moments and making them scenes, which I think adds an element to the play and more of a dynamic element than just a direct story, direct address play, which I think they really, really work. Because what it also does is it adds realism to the play, which I think is needed, because then the audience will buy into the characters and the situation more so than somebody just standing there telling them the story. They actually physically see them. And embody the characters.
Two very important themes within the play, and there are lots of important themes there for sure, but two very important themes are addiction. Jim is clearly has been addicted. He's clean now, but there's lots of things that he's saying now that you're worried that he could slip back quite easily. And domestic violence, these are huge themes to take on. What sent you in that direction?
I think... what I mentioned earlier is that I always try and talk about human stories, and I think these are issues that people can relate to and deal with, and they may not have experienced them themselves, but they know what it's like to be a husband or a brother or a son, and these issues are prevalent in society, and I want to talk about them, and I don't want to shy away from them either. But it's also adding a conversation to it, and we spoke about it before about the addiction element of the play, and in that it's Jim trying to grasp at what does he think his wife wants him to be? This confidence, this air of somebody else, to be a different person, which isn't who he is. So he feels he needs to alter who he is, and he feels, unfortunately, that drugs are the way to do that. And that's why we embody and we bring the voice of the addiction. We physicalize it in both halves of the play.
Yeah.
And I think it's really affecting when we hit it on the head, because we introduce it, first of all, and the audience don't know what it is. And then we go back in Act Two, we introduce what it is, and the audience know that it's the voice of his addiction that's following him around, and his urge to try and not be something else, try not to be his father.
And that aspect of domestic violence is certainly something that can't be shied away. While we don't see, I don't think, we will see a lot of violence on stage, Ian, I think we will, a lot of violence will be related to us, which in some ways can be more upsetting.
Yeah, no, it's all suggested. There's nothing very violent about the play, the way it's presented. I think those subjects are dealt with really sensitively in the script. And I think, again, in what you're talking about playing characters in broad strokes and stuff like that, that's why we're dealing with things that are very sensitive. So, you know, it's two male actors on stage, and a lot of the supporting characters are female as well, things like that. So you can't, you know, slip into sort of overacting or broad strokes or big choices like that.
And it did say, I want to be careful about talking about how things begin to resolve themselves coming towards the end of the second part of the play. Hayley, the wife character, and we're looking at her back at the time of this awful event, which has sent Jim's life already in a bit of a spiral, but it's really sent it off the rails. We start to see things from her point of view, and she makes some really difficult choices and takes quite extreme measures to follow things through. What kind of sympathy do you, where are you hoping our sympathies will lie in those scenes, particularly where Hayley has to make these, you know, rash, very, very difficult decisions?
So we spoke about this a lot when I was talked to Rex about the script when it was in draft one.
Rex Ryan, who's
the artistic director of Glass Mask. We knew we had to earn that moment because it's so...
And I want to be careful not to give anything away.
But it, as you said, it is extreme. And it's kind of, I was also very interested in what happens to somebody when they are pushed to the very end and they're left with no choice and they have to make a decision to alter their life for the greater good, for the life of their daughter. Mm. And we have spoken rehearsals too that we need to earn that moment, because if we don't get to that moment and the audience believes it, what does everything that precedes that do? We need to get to it and we need to build it and make it believable as a moment and understand where Hayley came from and why she made that decision.
And the other aspect of this is we have Hayley's side of that story, but we also have Jim. It's Jim who's telling us the story. And how much of a discussion have you had around how reliable is Jim? How much can we believe what Jim is telling us?
Yeah, I think me and Lee have slightly different feelings about this.
Yeah, we do.
That's good.
That is good, because it means I'm challenging the text a little bit. But I think what we get is very much, it is Jim's side of the story, but I think he's attempting to be honest, but I also think it's very open to ambiguity. And I think it is the sort of show that hopefully people will come see and you'll chat to other people about it afterwards. I think they'll be open for discussion afterwards as to who believes who.
And where you see, you believe we can believe him? That's kind of where you're sitting.
Yeah, I think so.
And are you slightly different from that then, Lee?
Well, I think like ambiguity.
I think it's more ambiguous.
Ian thinks it's more ambiguous, but I would think that it isn't, because when we tell the story, he also goes into the horrific things that he does. Mm. And I think if you're a reliable narrator, you tend to sugarcoat things that you did yourself and try paint yourself that you're not the wrong here and you're the only one that is justified in your actions and what you've done, whereas we don't do that with Jim.
Yeah.
He does some horrific things throughout the course of this play to get Hayley up against the wall, as we mentioned. But I do think, as what Ian said, it's always good when you come out of a play or you watch a film or you go see a show and you're talking with a fellow audience member and they got something totally different to what you did. There'll be people that come out and they say, I'm on Jim's side here, or I'm on Hayley's side.
Yeah.
And you want those conversations. I think good art should do that. It should challenge people. And I may have one thing and what I feel as the writer, but Ian, as the director who's putting a shape on this and bringing this to life, may have something totally different in his mind.
Yeah, well, I was watching a documentary, I think it was on BBC, during the holiday period, Stephen Ray talking about ambiguity and the importance of ambiguity, because it's not you telling the audience what they should feel or think, it's allowing them to make their minds up about it. you're heading into the final weeks. When do you, you're in the final week now, Ian?
Yeah, we're in rehearsals in tech now and previewing on Tuesday, Wednesday, opening Thursday next week.
All right. Well, listen, very best of luck and hope that it all goes very well for you. That is Jigsaw by Lee Coffey. It's at Glass Mask Theatre on Dawson Street in Dublin from the 6th through until the 24th of May. And you can get full details on glassmasktheatre.com. I think that most of us will know from history that Constance Gore Booth was the daughter of Anglo-Irish gentry from Lissadale House in County Sligo. But how did she become Constance Markovich? Who was Count Casimir Markovich, the man she married after meeting while they both studied art in Paris? Well, some of those questions will be answered with an exhibition at the State Apartments at Dublin Castle. Casimir Markovich, a Polish artist in Bohemian Dublin, 1903 to 1913. It's currently on view, is the exhibition. It's curated by Catherine Milligan and Emily Mark Fitzgerald. And Emily is with me in studio this evening. It is this, I said it to you before we came to air, Emily, that yes, we all know Countess Markovich, but I don't know that many of us, I certainly knew very little about Casimir. He was an artist. Did this all get lost in the revolutionary excitement that we mostly in this country we know of Constance Markovich from that point of view?
I think so, definitely. You know, he kind of drops out of the picture a little bit because he's only in Dublin about 10 years, you know, 1903 to 1913, which is the focus of the exhibition. And he's actually a very significant figure within the Irish Revival, within theatre, within painting and art and setting up art institutions. So the exhibition's really trying to kind of bring him back, as it were.
Yeah, so he deserves his moment in the limelight that perhaps Constance has had for quite a long time. And there are lots of different aspects to him, but they met at art college in Paris, wasn't it?
They did, yeah. So, I mean, this is a period where lots of students from Ireland and art students from Poland are travelling to Paris. It's really the epicentre of art education and bohemian life. And both of them come from families of the gentry. They're both attracted to Paris because
they can afford to be bohemian.
They can afford to be bohemian, but also because it's a place of liberation. It's a place where you can throw off, you know, your backgrounds and your upbringings and be there at the kind of, you know, the heart of the artistic world. So that's where they meet in 1899. And they're very similar in terms of their temperament and what they're interested in, so they immediately become attached.
Yeah, so they're attached purely on a romantic scale to start out, and I believe quite a romance too. There was no half measures in this particular suit.
Not at all, no. I mean, in the accounts of their meeting in Paris also reference not only the fact that they're very similar in terms of the things that they are enjoying in life, but they're also very tall. So everyone always comments on this because
you'd see them coming down the street.
Yeah, because Casimir was 6'4" and Constance herself was about 6 feet tall as well. So, you know, they seemed very well matched. They loved to cycle everywhere. They loved parties. So they really kind of become part of, you know, the bohemian lifestyle there in Paris at the time.
And bohemian lifestyle is one aspect of becoming to Bohemian Dublin in 1903. Artistically, how established were they, or particularly Casimir, how established was he at that period in Paris?
He's very highly regarded, actually. So he exhibits at the Paris Salon, for example. Both of them are enrolled in the Academie Julien, which is one of the main draws for especially Irish artists of the period. So they're there learning all of the kinds of things that students at that period are learning in Paris. They're learning about Impressionism, you know, they're being exposed to a whole range of different styles. And Casimir is a very accomplished artist, even at a young age. So one of the famous pictures of Constance that he creates actually is created during this period, during their courtship in Ireland.
Is this the full-length portrait of her in the white dress?
Yes, yeah, that's it. It's created in Paris and then it's now in the collection of the National Gallery of Ireland.
Yeah, these are available for you to look at on both X and Instagram at RTE Arena. And I'm just looking at that picture of her, or that painting of her. I mean, it is beautiful detail.
Mm-hmm. And it's huge. It's a huge painting.
Yeah. How tall is it? Well, you know, as often is the case for an art piece to look like life size, it has to be larger than life size.
It is, yeah. And it's about life size. You know, it's a very large painting. What's interesting in it too is that you see that she's wearing a wedding band. But this isn't a wedding band from her marriage to Casimir. This is a wedding band she purportedly wore this band that was a symbol of her marriage to art, that this was going to be her calling, as it were. So that's actually why she's wearing the wedding band in the photo, or in the painting, rather.
Yes, exactly. And again, she's profile onto us. She's a side profile onto us and gazing off in over towards the light. But really struck by the whiteness of her dress and how Casimir could capture that. How would you describe that style, Emily?
Yeah, it's quite a loose brushwork that he's using. It's a very kind of impressionistic style. At the same time, it's very much in the mold of a society portrait. It's very polished. It's very accomplished. It has these kinds of symbolic references as well to romantic love with the particular flowers that are on the table and whatnot. So it is really kind of showing her with this these associations of romanticism and love, but to a degree that's very, very highly finished.
Within the catalogue itself, there's a great picture of, and this is a photograph, of Casimir and Constance. And yeah, as you say, he's marginally taller than her, but they're both quite tall. Yeah. Again, looking off into the distance, a little bit of the dramatic and a little bit of the actor feel of the costumed feel of this particular photograph.
Absolutely. That was one of the most fun things about researching Casimir and Constance in this period is they both loved parties and fancy dress. And there's wonderful photographs and images of them indulging in this in Paris and also later on in Dublin as well.
Yeah, and the bicycle outfits, I believe, were particularly...
They cycled for their honeymoon in Normandy. So yeah, so this was a really keen part of their lives.
Yeah, well, these could be sexy. She's wearing kind of...
She's wearing kind of pantaloons.
Could possibly she could cycle with. However, the Paris period did end and they came back to Ireland. Was it difficult for Casimir to make that decision, do you think? Or was it just, there was no winning against Constance Markovitch?
It doesn't seem to have been any, you know, disagreement at all. He was very happy to move to Ireland and he really threw himself into Irish society immediately, despite the fact that by all accounts, you know, his English, he was still learning English. He and Constance spoke French to one another quite a lot. He becomes immediately sort of enmeshed in bohemian life in Dublin and is by all accounts is very happy.
How bohemian was life in Dublin? We talked about the bohemianness of Paris. How bohemian were things here?
Quite a bit. I mean, this is the high point of the Irish revival, you know. So you have Yeats and Lady Gregory starting the Abbey. You have all kinds of theatre activity happening both in the centre and also at the margins with lots of little companies staging work. You know, you have painters who are working in Dublin starting new organisations and exhibitions. And Constance and Casimir are right at the heart of all of that activity.
And Casimir had some sort of a background in theatre as well, did he?
Well, he didn't initially, actually. He comes into theatre when he moves to Ireland.
All right.
Yeah. So he gets the theatre bug, as it were, at that time. So he becomes really interested in the world of theatre. And it's not until 1907 that he actually appears on stage.
And he's originally from Ukraine and then they became Polonized, if that's the correct. Is that the adjective for when they moved to Poland, the family?
Yeah, no, it's a little bit of a complicated geopolitical background, but his family were actually Polish landowners who were settled in what is now Ukraine. Now, all of it was the Russian Empire at the time. So, of course, Russia and Poland and Ukraine have had a very complex history over centuries. But in essence, Casimir himself was born just outside of Kyiv and in what is now Ukraine. And so his family would have had, you know, they would have had peasants on their land who were Ukrainian, but had relatively good relationship with their Polish landlords.
So coming back then to this time that they were spending in Dublin and living in Dublin, and this exhibition concentrates on the period 1903 to 1913, so just that little bit ahead of the Easter Rising. How did he fare? How did Casimir fare here as an artist?
He fared pretty well. So on the one hand, while Casimir and Constance are very involved with bohemian life in Dublin, on the other, you know, Constance, she's a Gore Booth. So when she moves back to Ireland, she also becomes part of Dublin Castle and the Dublin Castle Society, which is a totally different, you know, side of a social circle from that. And Casimir, of course, is a member of the gentry as well. So he also kind of slides into that world very easily. So quite a number of his early patrons are actually people who are from the Anglo-Irish ascendancy, and they form important patrons for his work. And he does portraiture and other things like that.
Yeah, because I'm looking at another image within the catalogue, which is part of the Dublin Castle collection, in fact, is the investiture of the Earl of Mayo as a Knight of St. Patrick in 1905. So this is, he's already established enough to be getting this type of commission.
Absolutely. And for us as well, the fact that the exhibition is actually in Dublin Castle is particularly resonant because that as a site was so important for him in terms of this patronage and is very much a part of their early life. The both of them are regularly attending balls in Dublin Castle until 1908. We have some wonderful photographs of them from that time. And so they're kind of juggling these two spheres of their lives. On the one hand, the kind of bohemian, you know, theatre making and painting and art and philosophy, and on the other, being part of a higher society.
And how did he fare, and how did himself and Mr. Yeats fare with each other? I can't imagine that was a very happy relationship.
Well, I think when it comes to Irish theatre, gossip and rivalries always ensue. And that's the case too for Casimir, you know, because he is part of the groups of people who are starting alternatives to the Abbey. So he and Yeats did not always get along.
No, that
Yeats
would not go down well, no.
No. And so any kind of sense, you know, from Yeats and Lady Gregory that their turf was being encroached upon often was resisted. So, but what's really interesting is there have been so many more histories written recently about these smaller companies and how significant they were in terms of growing the culture around theatre in Ireland.
And you mentioned the connection with Ukraine and these, yes, they were considered to be good landlords. What was Countess Markovic, what was her attitude to that, given that she was coming from this Republican background and this, you know, nationalist background here in Ireland?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. Now, Constance and Casimir visit Ukraine together in 1902 and 1903. So in a sense, her visits there actually predate her involvement in the revolutionary movement. But what's really interesting is that we see in the work that she produces there, which is included in the exhibition, we have these marvelous photographs that are in the Markovic family descendants collections that Constance actually took of Ukraine, and paintings that both of them created there. And what we see is that she is beginning to have this interest in the peasant subject. She's interested in the landscape. And you can see that her kind of consciousness around nationalism is growing. And it's very much influenced by her experiences from with the Polish family, but also her time in Ukraine.
There was another image that struck me. It's of a Russian cottage. At what point was this done in Casimir's output?
That's fairly early on. And it's very similar to a lot of the paintings that he creates. Again, it's in quite a loose, impressionistic kind of brush style. And he painted quite a lot of these images of cottages. And again, this type of subject was really popular in French painting of the period. So they're not kind of unique in being interested in these kinds of subjects. But they painted both Irish and Ukrainian. And in this case, it's called a Russian cottage. But it's most likely actually in Ukraine.
Another one that I think we have also put up on social media is a portrait of George Russell, A.E., from 1904. This has a very different style in many ways. It's kind of a darkness and a very, if such a thing is possible to see in a painting, but it has a kind of a Russian feel. Russell has this look of Russianness off him in this portrait.
It does a bit. I mean, what you see, I think, in that portrait, which is just extraordinary, it's one of my favourite works of his, is this deep intellect of Russell. Mm. Yeah, so Russell is one of their first friends in Dublin.
And would Casimir have been more attached perhaps to George Russell A.E. than he was to W.B. Yeats?
Oh, definitely. No, he and Russell got on extraordinarily well. In fact, Russell's very first exhibitions as a painter were with Casimir and Constance. So that's the first time actually that he publicly exhibits his own paintings. And so all of them are very much involved in things like the United Arts Club. Constance and Casimir are regular attendees at A.E.'s salons that he held in his home. So that's a really important connection. And that portrait of A.E. that you're talking about was one of the first acquisitions of the Hugh Lane Gallery.
The only true bohemian is how Patrick Quigley describes Casimir Markovic in Dublin.
Yeah, Patrick is one of the most important biographers of Casimir. Yeah.
So he's perhaps a little biased on Casimir, is he?
Well, I suppose anyone who does a biography is a bit, but Patrick's done phenomenal work really looking at the life story of Casimir and also his son, Stashko, who is Constance's stepson, actually. And actually, by the way, Stashko becomes one of Constance's most important biographers. And so Casimir's son, he actually gives a lot of the material about Constance to the National Museum and National Library after her death. So he's very important to
the
story
Stashko,
as well.
And there's a wonderful portrait of Casimir in kind of military outfit, but very kind of decorative.
It's an imaginative, he's in the costume of a hussar.
Daddy but was you, a hero.
But I mean, it's all kind of a fantasy, but you see his kind of swagger and his personality really shining through that painting.
All right. Well, the exhibition is currently on display in Dublin Castle, and it runs through, I think I had it in front of me there, but I seem to have lost it now. It runs through until
the 14th of September.
14th of September, and Dublin Castle for full details on that. And that is our lot for this evening here on Arena. Paul Murnoch was on sound. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Research this evening was by Paula Shields, and the programme was produced by Reg Luby. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RTÉ Radio 1, and Ray Cuddihy will be with you after the news.